This is day four of the 2023 Shippensburg Bible School. Our second speaker this morning is Brother Mark Vincent from the Lapworth UK Ecclesia. The theme for Brother Mark's classes this week is Conquest, Joshua and the Canaanites. Today's class is entitled Rahab and Achan.
So we're going backwards today. We were in Joshua 6 yesterday. Today we're back in Joshua 2. And we'll spend some time there and then jump forward to chapter 7. So Joshua 2, Joshua the son of Nun sent two men secretly from Shittim as spies, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." And they went. And you'll see that the end of the chapter corresponds to that. So just as Joshua sends out the spies and they go across Jordan to Jericho, so at the end of the chapter they come back to Joshua and they give their report. So, you know, this is not immensely a revolutionary point, but you'll notice that the chapter begins and ends in the same way, and in fact, or in a parallel way. And in fact, the whole chapter is another one of these chiasm structures, A, B, C, B, A. So Joshua sends them out, and they come back. That's the A part. And then the B part is they arrive in Jericho, and the spies need protection, and Rahab provides that protection. And that's verses 2 to 7. And then the corresponding part towards the end of the chapter is that they escape from Jericho. They leave Jericho. And it's now Rahab in the future who's going to need protection, isn't it? And the spies and Israel are going to provide protection to Rahab. So there's a reciprocity about it. And you can see those two B parts match up. And that leaves a central section in the middle, which goes from verse 8 to verse 14. And those verses are tremendously important because those are Rahab's statement of faith, if you like. Those verses, the center of the chapter, provide the confession that she makes. And we shall look at those in just a moment. But let's carry on and finish the verse 1 that we'd started to read. The spies went and came into the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab and lodged there. And Rahab now, other than God, Rahab is the second character in the book to be named. So we have the name of Joshua. Joshua is a character. The tribes are named, but they're not characters in the narrative. We have Joshua, and the second human character to be named and participate in the action is Rahab. That's an interesting thing, isn't it? Rahab the Canaanite prostitute. So you couldn't, in a way, you couldn't get a more opposite counterpart to Joshua, could you? Joshua, who is the servant of Moses, the successor to Moses. So he's got all the boxes ticked in a way, hasn't he? But God also has a purpose for Rahab, the Canaanite prostitute. And it's interesting that she continues to be known as Rahab the prostitute. And you might have thought that she would say, you know, as the book of Joshua came to be written, look, could we just call me Rahab? Do we have to call me Rahab the prostitute? And yet, that is how it is. And in the New Testament too, it's Rahab the harlot, isn't it? But the point of that, I think, is not to denigrate her, not so that we should think less of her, but so that we should be reminded that the gospel is for all, whatever our background may be. And there is a space in God's purpose, even though Jericho was to be destroyed apparently without exception. You know, nothing that breathes except Rahab the Canaanite prostitute and her family. And God saves her, of course, because of the wonderful faith that she has. And so whenever we read that, it's a reminder to us, isn't it, not to discriminate against people and think, you know, there would be no hope for such a person. but rather to remember that sometimes it is the people who are on the edges who fit in less. It's perhaps easier and more pleasant to do middle class preaching, if you like. You know, to some degree, we have become a middle class community, perhaps, in the West, and therefore we can feel more comfortable with that kind of preaching. But Rahab is this person who doesn't quite fit into her own society and may be looked down upon in her own society. And she lives, doesn't she, in the wall. Just have a what, where is the verse? Is it verse 11? It's not verse 11. I've got it noted down here somewhere. Verse 15 it is. Let's just look at that now for a second. Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was built into the city wall, so that she lived in the wall. That's the ESV. I think the AV says on the wall. The word wall is actually occurs three times in that verse. Her house was built into the city wall. She lived in the wall of the wall. It is literally. So it's like you couldn't get any closer to the edge than she is. So she's in Jericho, but she's uncomfortable in Jericho. She doesn't fit there. She wants something else. So whereas the rest of Jericho is closed up and keen to remain as Jericho and to not let anything else in or out, she is on the edge. She is the marginalized person, and she is a person who is looking for something better, something which transcends. So in the spies come and they lodge there, and it's been speculated that, you know, that would be a place where there would be men going in and out, and often culturally it was a sort of a hotel and offered the prostitution services as well. So, you know, that was just how it was done in those days. It was the equivalent of an inn or a hotel, and so it would be natural for people to go and stay there. So that gave them potentially some protection, but whatever protection it was that they sought in their undercover mission, well, it didn't work, did it? Because the king of Jericho heard of it. And it was told the king of Jericho, "Behold, men of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land." Then the king of Jericho sent to Rahab and said, "Bring out the men who have come to you and entered your house, for they have come to search out the land." But you notice that Rahab was always one step ahead, wasn't she? She had thought this through. She had foreseen that there could be a risk of this arising, and she had already made preparations for it. And it's just interesting how it's like she is in control through the whole of the narrative, because she's not in control in the sense of she doesn't know how the spies are going to respond to her request to save her. She's certainly not in control of that. She's not in control of her own salvation. But in terms of ensuring the spies' safety, ensuring that they can stay there and then that they are released safely and don't get caught, she is the one who is coming up with all the plans that are going to take care of them, and take care of them she does. Excuse me. The woman had taken the two men and hidden them. And that little term is interesting because literally it says hidden him, which doesn't quite fit because, of course, there's two. So what is that? And perhaps it's an allusion, because the other place where that word occurs is in Exodus chapter 2, how the mother of Moses saw that he was a good child and hid him. And it's exactly the same expression that's used. So perhaps the grammatical oddity is there to make us make that connection with what Moses' mother had done in similarly disobeying the law, acting in a way that was not in the interests of the state or the city at that time, the ruling powers, the principalities and powers of the time, but doing it because spiritually this was the right thing to do. And she said, And this is interesting now because, you know, we get into the question of Rahab's lie, and I don't think the narrative is particularly interested in Rahab's lie, and it doesn't comment on it, but there is quite a lot of it true, she says, and of course it is true. She doesn't attempt to deny that. The men came to me, but I did not know where they were from, which is actually not true. And when the gate was about to be closed at dark, the men went out. Not true. I do not know where the men went. Not true. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them. Also not true. So, for some people, this is a big struggle, and we can think about, was there a different way she could have responded? But I really don't think it would have worked to say, oh yes, they're upstairs, but, you know, don't act too hastily here. Let's just sit down around the table and let's talk this through and maybe we can work this out. I don't think that would have worked. And I'm inclined to think, you know, if the Nazis knock on the door, in the Third Reich, and there are Jews that you're protecting in your basement, and they say, "Do you have Jews in your basement?" What do you say to that? And in a way, there is a challenge of competing principles here, then, isn't there? Because there is a principle of not seeing life made in the image of God destroyed. And there is a principle that we should tell the truth. But some have said, well, and you may find this helpful, you may not, that we should tell the truth to those who have a right to know that truth and a positive purpose in it. And in this case, there was no positive purpose. The purpose was to destroy life, wasn't it, and to try to thwart God's plan. And in the case of the Nazis knocking on the door, the purpose is to destroy life and to break God's commands. And so therefore, with those competing principles, a choice has to be made. And although, therefore, in other circumstances, we would, of course, seek to always tell the truth, and it would be better to just not answer than to tell a lie, there are perhaps circumstances like this where there are complete competing principles, where we can actually understand why Rahab does what she does, and she is not condemned for it in the narrative, and in fact her faith in taking care of the spies and welcoming them, speaking peace to them, as it puts it in Hebrews 11. So we've got both Hebrews 11 and James's testimony. And of course, the testimony is not specifically to commend the lie, but it is to commend the overall action that Rahab takes here in preserving the life of these people. So maybe that's maybe those are some worthwhile thoughts to consider. And it's these situations can arise where there are competing principles. So, you know, you're on the way to the meeting and you see someone lying, a sort of a Good Samaritan situation on the roadside as you're driving along. Now you could say, well, my responsibility is to be at the meeting, and if I stop here, there won't be time to get to the meeting. I mean, that's one way of following what is a right principle. And there's another principle about not passing by on the other side, isn't there? And actually stopping to help the person who is in need there. And so a choice needs to be made. So now we get to verse 8. And this is really then the center. This is structurally the center of the chapter. And in terms of its content, this is the center of the chapter, this wonderful confession of Rahab's faith. Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof, and she said to the men, "I know that the Lord has given you the land." She knows this. This is her faith, isn't it? She is committing to this. I understand the facts here. And look at the word she chooses. "I know that the Lord has given you the land." So she understands the very principle that we saw established in chapter 1 of Joshua, doesn't she? That this is by the gift of God, and all those references to the Lord gives, the Lord gives, the Lord gives the Canaanites, the Lord gives the land, that we counted in chapter 1, and we saw how they went through the book. Rahab understands that. This is in God's gift. This is God's prerogative. He has decided. And she now wants to fit in and be a part of what it is that God is doing. I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. And when she says that, you see, she then goes on to talk about the Exodus. We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt. When she says the fear of the Lord has fallen upon us and all the inhabitants of the land melt away because of you, and using those words fear and melt, or terror and quake, I think are probably the words in the King James Version. These are words from none other than Moses' song in Exodus 15 and verse 16. She knows the songs of Israel. She's, in a way, she's referring to the lyrics of that most famous of songs in Exodus 15. That's impressive, isn't it? That's the measure of understanding and faith that she has. And not only does she reference the Exodus from Egypt, she also refers to the start of the conquest, which was accomplished under Moses, what you did to the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you devoted to destruction. So this is this word now, you know, the devoted things, and we were talking about it, weren't we, how they were to take everything in Jericho and devote it to God. The first person to use that word, the first person to express an understanding that everything in Jericho had to be dedicated completely to God, is Rahab. This is the first occurrence of that term in the book, and it's on her lips. She understands a concept that, for us, as we were talking a bit yesterday, can be difficult to get our heads around. That's impressive too, isn't it? The remarkable faith of this woman. And we'll think more about that term, but it is this concept of everything must be given back to God, whether it is given willingly in sacrifice or whether it is given by something being consumed. You know, we will all be lit up by God, whether it's through our hearts burning within us, as it were, as we respond to His great plan and to the Scriptures, or whether it will be Him being glorified in the condemnation of sin, and like Pharaoh being raised up so that God would be glorified. And you remember, we'll just jump forward to it. You remember when Achan is about to be condemned, Joshua says, "Give glory to the Lord, my son." And Achan actually, although he had done that sin and had to die because of it along with his family, he actually does give glory to God by confessing his sin and by acknowledging the righteousness of God and the appropriateness of his death as a consequence of what he'd done. That's tough stuff, isn't it? But it remains true, even if it's difficult for us to get our heads around it. And of course, the word for devoted thing here, which these battles in which everything was to be consecrated to God, it's the Hebrew word cherem. And it becomes an important word in Joshua. We find out the instructions for it in Deuteronomy as well. And these were very special cases of devotion to God. It's actually the same word that the word harem comes from. Well, that's obviously a word from a very different context. But the idea of a harem is that these are the special set apart women for the person who has the harem. So that's obviously a sexual context. This is not a sexual context, but it is the idea of something being set apart and devoted to God, completely consecrated to him. And as soon as we heard it, she says, our hearts melted and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. And so here now we've got God's covenant name, haven't we? We've got the name Yahweh now being used by Rahab. And when she says he is the God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath, she recognizes the principles of Genesis 1 that we were talking about way back on Sunday. She recognizes his supremacy, and she uses an expression which sort of foreshadows the one that's going to be used in Joshua 6, where it says, "For the ark of the Lord the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing over Jordan." She's sort of giving us a foretaste of that in the expression that she uses. Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that as I have dealt kindly with you, and now here she uses the word chesed, that word for covenant faithfulness. So she's got all the words, hasn't she? Isn't it just a tremendous expression of faith, a tremendous statement of faith, of understanding from her, of God's purpose and of the principles on which his existence and activity is founded. As I have dealt kindly, showed that covenant faithfulness to you, you also will deal kindly with my father's house. And give me a sure sign that you will save alive my father and my mother and brothers and sisters and all who belong to them and deliver our lives from death. So she doesn't talk first about herself, does she? She says, as I have dealt kindly with you, please deal kindly with my father's house, that you will save my father and my mother, my brothers, my sisters, and all who belong to them. And only then, at the end, she says, and deliver our lives. Only at the end, she includes her own salvation, doesn't she, in that. There's a beautiful selflessness in that. And then the men respond to her. Do you see how the last word that she has spoken is the word death? Deliver our lives from death. She knows that without the grace of God, that is where this story ends, as it is where all human stories end. She needs now the grace of God to be extended to her, even as she has tried to show her faith in that grace, and even as she has tried to act and show by her works that she believes it. And the men said to her, "Our life for yours, even to death." And they recognize the stakes that are in play here for Rahab and her family, don't they? If you do not tell this business of ours, then when the Lord gives us the land, we will deal kindly, show that covenant faithfulness and faithfully with you. So I want to just make a little aside now. So we've talked about the fear and the quaking, haven't we? Or the fear and the melting, the terror and the quaking, whichever words in your particular translation. Now, I want us to think about that because it's an important question, isn't it? What do you do with your fear? And there are lots of examples of what people do with their fear as we go through the book of Joshua. So this is the first one in chapter 2, where she's described how her people have responded. They're frightened, and what do they do? Well, we've already seen that in chapter 6. Jericho was shut up within and without. None came out and none came in. That's one thing that you can do when you're afraid. You can go into lockdown, and we know what that looks like, don't we? And it's not good. That's not the answer to fearing and quaking, and that's not a comment about you know, what we should do about COVID and so on. Just to make that absolutely clear, I'm not commenting on that at all. But with respect to the fearing and the quaking that the nations around were having as a result of Israel's coming into the land and their exodus from Egypt, what should you do about that if you are one of the nations around? Well, we've seen what Jericho does. Let's have a quick look. We're going to come back to chapter 2, but let's have a quick look at chapter 5. As soon as the kings of the Amorites were beyond the Jordan to the west, and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over, their hearts melted and there was no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel. So there was this kind of wilting, wasn't there? This sense of inevitability. There's nothing we can do here. It sort of led them into a depression and an inability to act. Now, that's no good, is it? So it's like they deny that they have any agency here. They just melt away. The Canaanites shut themselves in. Chapter 6 we've already considered. Let's go on and look at the next example, and it's in chapter 9. And as soon as all the kings that were beyond the Jordan in the hill country and in the lowland, all along the coast of the great sea toward Lebanon, and then it lists the various ites, heard of this, they gathered together as one to fight against Joshua and Israel. So that's a different response, isn't it? That's, well, let's fight it. You know, let's summon together what power we have and let's focus it on attacking Israel. But when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Ai, they on their part acted with cunning and went, and you know the story, how they pretended that they'd come from a long way away and that they succeeded in making a covenant. Now, we're not going to have time to look at that narrative this week, but it was a different strategy, wasn't it? And it was a better strategy than the strategy of trying to fight with Israel. And what's interesting is that Gibeon, as we don't learn it until the next chapter, but we learn that Gibeon was actually one of the strongest cities in the area, and the men there were particularly mighty. But they recognized that their might didn't count for anything against the armies of God. And therefore, they hatched this plan to pretend and, you know, to wear out their bags and their shoes and their water bottles and everything and get their crumbly food and to bring it and to pretend. And then if we were going to go into chapter 10 and into chapter 11, we would see that both of those chapters too, and we look at those more tomorrow, they begin with the nations fearing and quaking, being terrified and saying, okay, what we need to do is respond with violence. What we need to do is confederate ourselves and go and fight. That's such a human response, isn't it? So we see that time and time again. We see the locking down. We see the hearts melting. None of those are the right answer. The right answer, of course, is to come to God. Israel had the thing too, didn't they? You know, when they saw the mountain a smoke and they heard the sound of the trumpet, they said, no, they drew back, didn't they? They didn't want to be closer to God. But the right response is actually to seek to draw nigh, to seek to approach him through the provision that he makes for us. And so in the examples of Rahab, we see what we should do. And in a way, in the example of what the Gibeonites do, I'm sure there was a better way than their cunning and deception, but actually it brought them into covenant, didn't it? It brought them into covenant with God and with the Israelites. And maybe the Israelites should have handled it better, and maybe they should have asked God's counsel, which they didn't. But the Gibeonites were prepared to accept this position of servitude. Even though they were mighty men, they were prepared to humble themselves so that they could be a part of the promises that God had made. So some interesting examples, this theme, isn't there, of different ways of responding. Let's go back to chapter 2, because we need to uh, we need to complete the Rahab narrative. So we've got to verse 15. Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was built into the wall, in the wall of the wall, as we've already looked at. So she lets them down by this rope, and she says to them, go into the hills, for the pursuers will encounter you and hide there 3 days. Then afterwards, you may go your way. So what she's doing is she's saying, don't go straight back east home, go into the west, hide out there for a while, and again, she comes up with the plan, doesn't she? The plan that will save them, and she lets them down in the window through the window, and I think we'll just skip through all of that. And we come to verse 21, and she said, according to your words, so be it, which might have a New Testament echo, mightn't it, of another faithful woman. And she sent them away, and they departed, and she tied the scarlet cord in the window. She didn't wait around, did she? She didn't say, oh, well, I'll get to that. You know, I'll go make some dinner first, and then worry about what else she had to worry about. And at some point, she'll put the scarlet cord up. That's the very next thing in the narrative, isn't it? They departed, and she tied the scarlet cord in the window. She was going to do this straight away. Now, it could be that was part of, that was part of how you recognized a prostitute's house, and so hanging it up there was, some cultures still have the red light as a sign, you know, the red light district. That may or may not be the case, but of course there is this echo with Passover, isn't there? And the marking of the blood, and here we have this scarlet cord in the window here rather than over the doorpost. And they go and report back to Joshua. Now, there is a counterpart to this narrative, and of course it is the narrative of Achan. Because, Rahab is there in a Canaanite city, isn't she? But what she treasures in her heart are the things of God and the promises and what God is going to do with Israel. And so she is saved out of the city that is devoted for destruction. Whereas Achan takes things from that city and puts them in the heart of his house and buries them there in the earth. He takes the devoted things and puts them in his tent. And it's perhaps interesting that the consonants of Achan's name are also the consonants that are found in the term Canaanite or Canaan. There are extra consonants as well in Canaanite, but all the consonants of Achan's name are in there. And in a way, by taking of the things of Canaan, the things of Jericho that should have been devoted to God, he shows that at least part of him, that he wants to have part of Canaan in his house, doesn't he? He wants this connection with what is Canaanite. And he takes this garment from the land of from Shinar and, you know, with all the symbolism that has, and this money, this these talents of money. So, you know, what is the garment about? The garment from Shinar. Well, maybe it's a fashionable thing. I don't know, but maybe it speaks of a cultured thing. You know, this is how you show your sophistication. And money, of course, well, we all understand the attraction of money, don't we? You don't need me to expound on that. And, you know, you can, as human beings, we can understand the reasoning that he probably went through. You know, how can I let that go to waste? Like, it's just, we're just going to destroy it. This could have been sold for much and given to the poor. You know, that we find all kinds of ways of justifying things, don't we? But it's what God has said which should carry the day. And Achan refuses to make that be the case for him. Let's go to chapter 7 then and have a look at some of the verses there. But the people of Israel broke faith in regard to the devoted things. For Achan, the son of Carmi, son of Zabdi, son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, no less, took some of the devoted things. And the anger of the Lord burned against the people of Israel. And again, we won't go through this now, but again, chapter 7 can be seen as one of these A, B, C, D, E, F, and then back to A again structures, you know, one of these ring structures, these chiastic structures. And so, you know, feel free to go through that for yourselves. But just to give you a clue there, the burning anger is referred to at the beginning of the chapter, and it's referred to again at the end of the chapter. And the center of the pattern, which is, you know, almost always the point of these structures, is what we find at the end of verse 12. It says, "I will be with you no more unless you destroy the devoted things from among you." That's the central point of the chapter, that second half of verse 12, if that structural idea is correct. So they go out, don't they? They go out to spy out the land in verse 2. We're, of course, the narrator lets us in on the secret, doesn't he? So there's this dramatic irony where we know this isn't going to go well because God's angry and Israel has broken faith. But, of course, Israel themselves don't know that yet. And they start by sending out spies just like they sent out spies for Jericho. So they would have expectations. They've seen what God can do with Jericho. And they now have expectations, don't they, that God is on their side and that this, you know, is going to be a sort of walk in the park. Of course, this is all going to be fine. We know what to do here. And they say, "Look, relax, Joshua. Don't make the whole people go up. This is going to be easy for us, given what..." But do you see what it is? This is going to be easy for us. From a human perspective, this is a straightforward one. We don't need to worry about this. And of course, here, as in chapter 9, they don't consult with God. They just go off, and then they have this terrible shock when the men of Ai kill about 36 of their men and chase them from the gate of Shechem and strike them at the descent. And the hearts of the people melted, I'm now at the end of verse 5, and became as water. So do you see what's happened? Israel is now having the response that the Canaanites were having, yeah? But here, the melting and the quaking and the terror has now come upon Israel. Now, it's perhaps a bit of an overreaction because God has been gracious to them. Only 36 of their men have died. I mean, it could have been a lot worse than that, couldn't it, given the anger of God and the significance of what was at stake here. But this comes as a mighty shock to them. And you can see Joshua's extravagant reaction as he tears his clothes and lies on his face till evening. And, you know, what's interesting about the prayer of Joshua is that he focuses on God's name. You know, he understands that this is about God manifestation. But God seems to have relatively little patience with Joshua, doesn't he? The Lord said to Joshua, verse 10, "Get up, why have you fallen on your face?" Like, what are you doing down there? And then he explains what it is that Israel have done and why, therefore, circumstances have transpired like this. And a brother came to me yesterday, and it was a really good point, that what's happened now is that the Lord has fought against Israel. So this is another dimension to, are you for us against us? And the commander of the Lord said no. This is another aspect, isn't it? Whether he is for you or against you depends on whether you have faith and whether you approach him in the correct way and whether you do the right things and obey his commandments. And so we're seeing the flip side here. When we don't do that, then there is danger at hand, as the Israelites here are discovering. Let's look at how God characterizes the sin that has taken place. Israel has sinned, one. They have transgressed my covenant that I commanded them. And very powerfully here, God uses, when he says transgressed, it's using our old favorite word that we recognize from chapter 3 and 4. They have crossed over. They have passed over. It's like they've gone back across the Jordan in this act. They have transgressed my covenant that I commanded them. Let's not do that. Let's not go back again and rebuild what we've destroyed through God's grace in baptism. They have transgressed my covenant, so that was two. They have taken some of the devoted things. Three. What Israel are supposed to be doing is taking Canaanite cities. This was one of our key words from this section of Joshua, wasn't it, on that second scheme we looked at on the first day. But instead of taking Canaanite cities, Achan has taken some of the devoted things. It's like, oh, it's a real moment, isn't it, of having not completely misunderstood what they were supposed to be doing. That was the third point, wasn't it? Four, they have stolen. Five, they have lied. And six, they have put them among their own belongings. They have misappropriated what is God's. And so again, really, this is a sort of a reinforcing of the exhortation we had from Brother Roger when we were thinking about Andrew, wasn't it? About taking the things that we have and devoting them to God, making sure that we use them and not misappropriating things for ourselves or thinking that they're just ours to do whatever we like with. And the what seems to us drastic response in the death of Achan and his family is, there's a New Testament parallel to that, isn't there, with Ananias and Sapphira. And there the problem, of course, as we know, wasn't that they had resources that they didn't give to the Lord. It was that they claimed that they had given things to the Lord while they kept things back for themselves. Therefore, the people of Israel cannot stand before their enemies. Standing was one of those important words, wasn't it, as well, earlier on. They turn their backs before their enemies because they have become devoted for destruction. So because they have taken what is Canaanite when they shouldn't, it's like there's a contamination from that spreads. And Israel as a whole, to some degree, and certainly the immediate family, have become contaminated by that sin. And that is a principle that we see at various points in the law of Moses, where different sins, linking to last night about God manifestation, different sins have different degrees of ramifications, different degrees of contamination under the law, depending on the nature of the sin and how serious it is in the sight of God. Of course, all sin is wrong and is unacceptable to him. But we are taught about this system of different degrees of contamination. And this one, with the first fruits of the land of Canaan, which was to be completely devoted to the Lord, is particularly a serious one, isn't it? I will be with you, we're in verse 12, aren't we? They turn their backs before their enemies because they have become devoted for destruction. They have become Canaanite, as it were. And God must now consume them if they don't repent, because he will have what is his. I will be with you no more unless you destroy the devoted things from among you. That's the second reference to devoted things in that verse. Get up, consecrate the people, and say, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow. For thus says the Lord God of Israel, there are devoted things, third reference, in your midst, O Israel. You cannot stand before your enemies until you take away the devoted things from among you. There now is the fourth reference. So you see, what they have to do now is, as they've taken things that they shouldn't have taken, now they have to take away those devoted things from among you. And so God then explains how the next day, the tribe that the Lord takes, here's the word again, so because they have taken, God will take them. And then the tribe, and then the clan, and then the family is taken, isn't it? Until at last Achan himself is identified and taken. And the, And he who is taken, verse 15, with the devoted things shall be burned with fire, he and all that he has, because he has transgressed the covenant of the Lord and because he has done an outrageous thing in Israel. And there, I think that's using the word, you know, the word Nabal, folly is his name and folly is with him. They've done an outrageous thing in Israel. And of course, that happens, and Achan is taken. Give praise or give glory to him and tell me what you have done. Do not hide it from me as you hid the things in your tent. And all of those things that he had hidden are now revealed, aren't they? And they're laid out now for all to see. And there is nothing hidden which will not be revealed. And the secret thoughts and, you know, the things that we have, those things are naked and open with him to him with whom we have to do. So there is no hiding from him, is there? So we're better to just be open in the first place, aren't we? To be honest about our sins and to confess them before him and to seek his forgiveness, to recognize what is his and to seek to render it to him. Verse 24. So as Jericho had to be destroyed, so Achan now, because he took what was of Jericho, must be destroyed. And Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan, the son of Zerah. But they didn't just take Achan, did they? Look again at this verse. And often the word "and" isn't particularly important, but this is a counterexample where it is important. They took Achan the son of Zerah and the silver and the cloak and the bar of gold and his sons and daughters and his oxen and donkeys and sheep and his tent and all that he had, and they brought them up to the valley of Achor. Why did you bring trouble on us? Achor and Achan, the N and the R, again, look pretty similar in Hebrew. So there's a play on the words again. And they stoned him with stones, and there was this burning as well. And a pile of stones was made to commemorate that. So again, we've got two parallel examples, haven't we? A positive example and a negative example in Rahab and Achan. And we learn that there are consequences, there are wider implications from what we do. It wasn't just Achan, was it? It was all that he had that had to be destroyed, just as it was all that was in Jericho that had to be destroyed. So that was why it was all that he had, perhaps. And, you know, we can speculate about maybe his family members were complicit in the taking of these things, and that was why. That could possibly be the case, just as it could be the case that maybe Rahab's mother and father and relatives were also faithful, and that was why they were saved. But that is, at the end of the day, speculation. The principle here seems to be to make us think about the wider implications of our actions, whether that is for the negative in the case of Achan, or whether it is for the positive. You know, that our example, the things that we do, and the way we behave, and the way we come across has implications for our relatives, for those we work with, for those in our ecclesia. Therefore, we should think very carefully about them. Our concluding point, let's just go back to chapter 6. We've seen the beauty of Rahab's confession. And though she was a Canaanite, and though she had been a prostitute, yet there is a place for her, not only amongst God's people, but in the very lineage. And we saw yesterday, didn't we? Do you remember that little speech in chapter 6 where there was that pause between shout and then the actual account of the shout? And we saw, didn't we, that in between verses 16 and 19, we saw that the central part of that little shape, that little ABCBA shape, was only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her and her house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. So she's protected. There are two references in that speech to the devotion to destruction, but she is protected. and she is protected because she is already devoted to the Lord, isn't she? So she doesn't need to be devoted to destruction because of her devotion to him, as we have seen. And that's not the only reference. In the heat of the excitement with which the walls fell, you know, they shouted and the walls fell down and they all went rushing up to Jericho. And you can imagine the intensity of that moment. But there is a pause, isn't there, in verse 22. But to the two men who had spied out the land, Joshua said, go into the prostitute's house and bring out from there the woman and all who belong to her, as you swore to her. And so they did that, and they brought out Rahab. And then there's a third reference as well in the chapter to Rahab. So in that destruction of Jericho, there is this wonderful salvation that is possible for all those who are truly devoted to him.